Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. What an amazing thing is going on in this crazy story regarding feline infectious peritonitis. A new compounded option is available to treat FIP. I'll talk about that. And also, so many of you are hitting the road with your pet. But what if your pet doesn't want to go? We have an expert. Dr. Raina Carlson is the immediate past president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. Does that sound official?
Yes. Doesn't it sound official?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. And you are official, but you are the immediate past president. What was the best thing? We're going to talk about summertime safety tips for pets in a moment. I'm curious, though, what was the best thing? Maybe the worst thing about being the president of the American Veterinary Medical Association for 1 year, which is what the term always is. It's not that you were booted out or anything, but what was the best thing about it? And what was the thing that I wasn't so crazy about that part?
So the best thing, hands down, is just interacting with people, veterinarians and their teams, and the people that, you know, are associated with the veterinary profession are simply the most compassionate, resourceful, kind people on the face of this planet. And I could not be more proud to be part of that group. So meeting veterinarians, getting a lot of different perspectives, understanding the challenges, and bringing that back to AVMA so we can do what we can to help face some of those challenges. But as I'm sure you can attest to, the worst part is delayed and canceled flights.
I totally get that. Although I shouldn't say this, but I will. I've been lucky lately. So
I know.
Right. Be careful how we say that.
I know.
That's bad luck that I even said that, I think.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have said it. Sorry.
Well, thank you for your service, because I know this is not a well-paying gig. It is something that you and all the presidents that have become before you. Now, I think you're the, I may be counting wrong, fourth woman to be president of the AVMA?
Let me count here. I'm the...
Dr. Leininger, I think, was the first.
Leininger, Bonnie Beaver, Renee Carlson, Lori Teller. So I'm five.
Five, yeah. Representing the profession. I mean, that's the way it should be. But this is a time of year, and one of your goals, I know, as president, is to help make things better for pets. And a lot of the problems we see in summer where, yeah, boy, it's heating up all over the country, these problems are oftentimes avoidable. If pet parents, I mean, no one wants, for example, a dog to die in a hot car. Dr. Carlson, the numbers, and you've been talking about this forever, I have been, many people have been, yet the numbers are up of dogs that actually have succumbed in hot cars. Can we once again warn people about that?
Yeah, we just can't emphasize it enough, and not even for a minute. I don't care if you're just going across the parking lot to say hi to somebody. Not even 1 minute. That dog should never be in the car, or multiple dogs, whatever it is, alone, ever. You know, people will say, well, I've got the air conditioning on. They should not be unsupervised. You don't know what's going to happen. They can get stressed. They're cooped up in there. It is so important to just really think about, when you put them in the car, where are you going? And if you need to get out of the car, even for a minute, leave your pet at home. You're going to be so much happier to be greeted at home with that pet than to have the tragedy that might happen if you either forget or you get distracted or something happens and you can't get that pet out of the car quick enough. So I'm like you. I don't know how to stress it enough. It's just tragic, and it's so sad to think of what those dogs go through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think one thing we forget is how hot cars get. But the other thing that I think people don't realize is that if you're hot, your dog, no matter what kind of dog you happen to have, and we'll talk a bit about some of the differences, but no matter what, dogs are not as efficient at cooling themselves as people. So if you're hot, your dog is way hotter than you are.
Absolutely. And we have to think about their body temperature in general is warmer than ours. And then you add the fact that they don't get rid of heat very well. The only way they can get rid of heat is to pant. They do have some small sweat glands on their paws and the top of their nose. But the primary way they keep their body temperature in control is panting. And that's not a very efficient way to dissipate heat out of their body. So when the outside temperatures are super hot, panting just is not going to get rid of that heat for them.
And I want to talk about dogs that have even more difficulty. So what you just said is true if it is a dog. So let's break it down a little bit. Let's say we are talking about dogs with dark colored coats, black or brown coats. Now we know, I don't know if it's instinctive or not, or we learn it as kids, that if it's 90 degrees out, you don't wear black, you wear a light color, because then the heat reflects back. But dogs cannot change their t-shirt. They don't have a choice in the matter. And dark-colored dogs actually do get hotter, Dr. Carlson.
They do, because that sun, the black coat, is absorbing heat, and it's transmitting that heat down into the body of the dog. So here's the dog already generating its own body heat. Maybe we're, you know, walking or doing something that's generating even more body heat. And again, it's overwhelming for their cooling system. And they very quickly go into heat stress. And that's another really important part of this, is you don't have a lot of time to recognize that. So prevention is so, so important.
And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about signs of heat stroke. We'll talk about prevention. We'll talk about big dogs, older dogs, smaller dogs, and all things. And you know what? Cats, too. We will talk about all of that when we come back on WGN with the immediate past president of the American Veterinary Medical Association, Dr. Raina Carlson. Dr. Raina Carlson, immediate past president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. We're talking about heat stroke in dogs, essentially dogs that can overheat, and how easily this can happen. We'll talk about signs of that in a moment. We did talk about how if you have a little white fluffy dog, that dog isn't as likely to get as hot as, say, a chocolate lab or a dark-colored dog of any kind, just because white reflects back off and that dark color doesn't, and the dog's already warm can get a whole lot hotter. But there's some other variables, including size of dog. Do big dogs have more of an issue?
Well, it kind of depends. There's this phenomenon or a physics thing of surface area to volume ratio. So if you've got something that's really skinny with a lot of surface area, they actually, you know, can get rid of heat a little more efficiently than something that's more round, because that's not going to have a different surface area to volume ratio. So again, breed and the shape of their body and the size of their body play a big role in that. And that's where your veterinarian can give you a little more information on your individual dog. And then you have to look at their respiratory system, because like we said, the only way they get rid of heat, or the biggest way they get heat out of their body, is to pant. So how efficient is that panting system? If you have a older dog, maybe their respiratory system isn't as effective. If you have some other diseases going on, heart disease, respiratory disease, kidney disease, liver disease, anything that is affecting that dog metabolically is going to make it harder for them to, again, pant and really get rid of that heat.
Now, I'm glad you brought up older dogs, because people often don't and forget about the fact that a geriatric dog is going to have a difficult time in very hot weather, just like a geriatric person would have and does have a difficult time when it's very, very hot out. What about this? It turns out about 50%, I think, is the number now, of dogs are overweight or obese. Does that play into it as well? The shape, the dog, you mentioned shape. Well, I'm talking about shape as well, in a different way, or maybe the same way.
And it's actually the same way, because again, you've got more volume that's generating heat. So the heavier they are, the harder it is for them to get rid of that body heat that they're generating. And again, just even a lean dog, if they're one of the really big muscular dogs, like the Staffordshire Terrier, like they're very big and muscular, so they don't have as much surface area, and that muscle is generating heat, and they have to pant to get rid of that heat. So again, so many factors, and we haven't even talked about their nose and their face structure.
Right. That's true, too. And brings me to this point. What about the dogs that have that face structure where they look like they walked into a wall? Like the brachiocephalic breeds, the fancy words for dogs that have a fancy word for dogs that have limited airways, that English bulldog, the French bulldogs, the pugs, the Pekingese, those dogs are not going to do a marathon anytime. But when it's really hot outside, they have a difficult time walking around the block.
Exactly. And just as you've said, they're called brachiocephalics, which means they've got that shorter nose. Once again, it affects their respiratory system. So you have to think about panting is a big part of the respiratory system has to be functioning well for that panting mechanism and cooling mechanism to work. And those breeds, they're very popular right now.
Mm-hmm.
People love a lot of those different breeds. So they're very sweet little dogs, very great companions, but they are not going to tolerate the heat, and they're not going to be able to pant efficiently and get rid of that heat. So another factor or another thing to kind of be considering when you're thinking about how well is my dog going to tolerate the heat.
All right. So what do you do? We have a prediction here, you know, of which dogs are going to do better than others. But how can you tell your dog, your individual dog, isn't doing well and maybe even moving toward heat stroke?
And at the end of the day, you know, we talk about all these factors, but at the end of the day, any of them are at risk. And you just have a small window of differences when you talk about, you know, the different breeds and different risk levels. But it's so important when you're out and about or you're doing something, keep an eye on your dog. I mean, we're distracted with activities and picnics and people and whatever we're doing, but don't forget to watch your dog and their behaviors, because oftentimes they're panting. Dogs pant. That's just a normal thing, and we're used to them panting. But when you see them panting, really watch. Is that a frantic pant? Are they really panting hard? Are they drooling? Are they, you know, maybe they vomit, acting a little bit weak? Those are all the signs that they're starting to get into trouble. Look at the color of their gums. Should be a healthy pink, but when they get into what we call that brick red, that really much darker red, their tongue's way out, their eyes look stressed. All those signs can indicate they're getting into trouble, and it's important to get them out of that situation as quick as you possibly can and get them into a cool place and really think about getting veterinary care quickly.
All right. So that brings us to the next question. Thank you very much for that. Do you bring the dog into your house and put your dog in the bathtub? Do you rush to a veterinarian even if you're not sure what's going on? What do you do?
Well, it's always better to be safe than sorry. I'd much rather see my clients come in and me be able to say, hey, let's just do this minor thing and everything's going to be fine. We're all happier with that. So, you know, when in doubt, get professional help, get veterinary care as quick as you can. But you can, if you catch those signs very early and you get them in an air-conditioned room or air-conditioned car, and they calm down quickly, then we feel much more comfortable that we've caught those signs early, we're able to help them get cooled off. Again, fresh water, you want to be a little careful. You don't want to cool them off too quickly. So some people are like, you know, get ice on them or get them ice cubes. You do want to be a little careful about doing it too quickly, but get them in, you know, air conditioning can really, really help. And they should start calming down within a few minutes. And if not, you better be thinking about, you know, rushing them into veterinary care.
Yeah, and a damp towel over their backside can help a little bit, or on their stomach, actually.
Yeah.
Can help a little bit as well. I want to talk about dogs that are outdoors. You're walking along, and it looks like that dog is doing an imitation of, I don't know, from some Fred Astaire movie and doing a little dance on hot pavement. Is that because the dog wants to entertain you?
No, probably not. They like to entertain you, but probably in much different ways. And honestly, you're lucky if the dog tells you, because a lot of times they won't. Dogs are so interested in making sure they're doing what they think you want them to do. I've seen patients that come in and the owner really could not tell that they've burnt those pads until they've got raw pads, bleeding pads, and they can't walk. So always, get down and touch the sidewalk. See how hot that really is. And they do have a little extra keratin on those pads, so they're a little more protected than, say, our feet or hands, but not for a long period of time on that super hot surface. So if you need to walk across a sidewalk really quick, that's probably okay. But if you're on a sustained walk on asphalt or pavement, you're really putting them at risk of burning those paws. And so if they dance around, absolutely get them off, because you know. But sometimes they don't tell you, and that's where
that's
the
right.
real challenge comes
yeah.
in.
Yeah. All right. Much more to talk about with Dr. Raina Carlson, who is the immediate past president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. I want to talk about swimming. That seems like a good thing. It's a great way to cool off. But there might be some downsides of your pet in your own swimming pool. We'll explain what I mean when we come back here on WGN. Next week on the program, we'll talk about boarding your dog. We're going to be talking later in this show about traveling, but one option for a lot of dogs, even more cats, is leave me at home. But then where do they go? So we'll talk about that next week with Jay Spanauer of Tucker Pups. We'll also talk with the author of a book about triggers and reactions having to do with aggressive dogs on a leash with Jeff Millman, who's a dog trainer. So much of what is being said now, this is a huge issue. And it is even more an issue in an urban area, right? Because the dogs are always on a leash. And what we have is what is sometimes called leash reactivity. What do you do about it? There's good news. And Jeff Millman will explain that good news. That's next week right here on Steve Dale's Pet World. Dr. Raina Carlson is the immediate past president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. So we're talking about keeping pets, dogs, and we'll get to cats too, particularly safe in the summer. Let's say you're a lucky person and you have a swimming pool. But you know what, Dr. Carlson? I think that pugs and French bulldogs and Pekingese, if they go into the pool, it's like sinking like a rock. They generally don't swim. The other concern I have, so life preservers, life vests, but the other concern I have is even for dogs that think they're Michael Phelps, then they still need a way out of the pool. They can't swim forever. So even Labradors or Newfoundlands, Portuguese water dogs, they still need to understand how to get out, and it has to be easy for them to get out.
Exactly. And I think pools have a lot of concerns for me, for pets in general. And you've mentioned a number of those. But I want to mention even just the chlorinated water. That's not really the healthy things. Dogs are going to get in there and lap up water and swallow water. So I'm not real excited about them swimming in chlorinated pools to begin with. And then you're right. If they fall in the pool and they're where there's no steps, they can't get their feet on underneath them, they're not going to be able to crawl out of that pool. So that really is a big concern. And then you have, like you said, the different breeds. Obviously, the certain breeds are just really built to swim. Labradors, the Spaniels, all the water dogs and the hunting dogs that are really just built to swim, they're usually pretty good at swimming around and being okay, but they still wouldn't be able to climb out of the side of a pool, where it goes straight up and there's concrete or tile or whatever. And that's pretty dangerous. They're going to wear out after a while. And if they're unsupervised, it's going to be a tragic situation. But swimming, as we're out in the forest or hiking on trails or going to the lake, swimming can be a great thing. I do recommend, however, if you're out on the boat, you never know when that dog's going to launch off the side of the boat. So having a life preserver can truly be a lifesaver for our pets. So think about that, as well as make sure you bring fresh water. Again, dogs are going to want to drink wherever they're at, but if we keep them hydrated with good, clean water that's safe, they're going to be less likely to be wanting to drink out of the creek and the pond and worry about Giardia or some of the algal blooms that we can see that can be toxic. So lots of different things to be thinking about.
Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left here, and that's all I have left for cats. But it seems that cats, while they do get heat stroke, don't succumb as often because they don't put themselves in a situation. And they're also not running and running and running when they're outdoors.
Cats are sprinters. They're not marathon runners like dogs are. So as well as, especially cats inside, they're not going to be exposed to, of course, the heat. But cats are really good at kind of just hiding in a shaded place and really, you know, just not doing anything to generate body heat. But the one thing I really want to mention, if your cat is open mouth breathing, they're probably in a bad way. Mm. They're probably already in that crisis situation. So dogs pant, you have to watch that and see kind of that frantic panting versus normal panting. But if a cat is open mouth breathing, that's probably an emergency situation.
Yeah, and if it's not a heat stroke and you say, oh, my cat is inside, it's air conditioned. Well, what you said is also a sign potentially of heart disease or other issues, no matter what. Yeah.
Yep, asthma. There's multiple things. So if they're open mouth breathing, that's an emergency. Get them in now.
Yep. Well, there's an emergency that I have to go. We're out of time. Dr. Raina Carlson, immediate past president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. As always, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for the great information.
Thank you so much, Steve. Really appreciate you.
Feline infectious peritonitis, or FIP, has been a dramatic story. And that's an understatement. So much so that I'm told someone is going to be writing a book about all the twists and turns. I mean, really, it can be a movie on Netflix for all the drama that's occurred here. And it's so emotional because it mostly happens to babies. It happens to little kittens. It wasn't understood forever and ever and ever. The Wynn Feline Foundation, now called the Every Cat Health Foundation, a nonprofit that funds cat health studies, funded Dr. Niels Peterson, University of California, Davis, for decades, and other researchers all over the world, even just to figure out what the heck's going on here. How this coronavirus in cats, what that has to do with causing this fatal disease called feline infectious peritonitis. Finally, understood at some point in time. And Dr. Peterson himself said, I think here's a drug, an antiviral drug, that really will help. The drug is from a pharma company called Gilead, and in fact, it did more than help. These cats, these kittens, appeared to be cured. Amazing. So now wants that Gilead drug to be available, but Gilead says no. Another drug becomes available, and in fact, the Food and Drug Administration Center for Veterinary Medicine, they haven't said no. They just said, well, not yet. In the meantime, kittens, of course, continue to get sick from FIP. What do we do in America? China came in and said, oh, we've got something. We can figure it out. And their products do work, unfortunately, or greatly do work. Unfortunately, they're totally not approved. It gets very confusing, doesn't it? Well, I've got one more twist here. Stokes Pharmacy has said very recently, aha, we can do a compounded product of that original drug from that original pharma company. It's not exactly legal, but it's kind of legal. In any which case, it's available now, at least through your veterinarian. Can you believe it? So the good news is this product really can work. It's a compounded tuna-flavored product. It's from Stokes Pharmacy. If you know someone or maybe your own kitten has been diagnosed with FIP, that's tragic still, but probably that kitten now, definitely that kitten has a good chance of making it. And the result of that is what we now know about the antivirals that are now available through humans, for humans, only because of kittens getting FIP in the first place. In any which case, you can read far more about it on my website, and that's stevedale.tv. Next, we talk about pet travel with Dr. Chris Pockel. So it is that time of year where more and more people are traveling, it turns out, with their pets, taking your furry members of the family to wherever you're going in the car. Dr. Chris Pockel is a veterinary behaviorist. First of all, is that a good idea to take our dogs with us? Or cats?
I love the idea of being able to vacation and travel with your pets. I think the mistake that some people make going into that is assuming that their pet wants to come along where they may not have actually asked them their opinion.
So how do we do that? Send an email? How does that work?
text message. Yes. Yeah, I love that idea. Maybe a little messenger. Yes. I think asking the question is really starting out with really easy approximations of what, you know, a week on the road might look like. So asking that question, if I take my dog to the store or we're going to grab something from the coffee shop drive through and I bring my dog along, do they seem like they're enjoying themselves? Are they comfortable? And not just do they seem excited to go, but can they actually settle in? If we do a little bit of a longer car ride for 30 minutes, 45, do they actually settle in, or are they amped the entire time in a way that actually might be problematic if you were, you know, going to be on the road for a longer period of time?
So if you want to take that dog or cat that's just a little bit anxious, are there some things we can do to help?
I think there are. Number one, set them up for success. Make sure they're comfortable in the vehicle with the equipment, the setup, all of those sorts of things. Perhaps take them for a walk or give them an outlet for some of that energy before we get in the car so they're more likely to settle in.
By equipment, you mean cat carrier or dog carrier if it's a small dog, or even, what do they call them, doggy seats?
Absolutely. And sometimes we trial all the things, right? Some dogs are more comfortable being seatbelted. Others are more comfortable in a crate. Others, you know, we kind of cobble something together based on the comfort of that particular animal, whether that's laying the seats flat and giving them a room to sprawl. Lots of different options, but looking at their body language to see whether or not they're truly comfortable.
Okay, so you've gotten to that point, but the dog is not truly comfortable, or cat. Are there some other things we can do if we don't take the alternative you suggest as a possibility and just not take them?
Yeah, you know, I think it's always on the table to not take them, but absolutely doing a couple of short car rides to see, with a bit of exposure, experience, habituation, do they settle in? Does it get better? Does it get worse? Or do we potentially want to reach out to a veterinarian and say, gosh, are there some supplements or pheromones or medication that might be helpful? If it's important enough to bring that cat or dog along, what can we do to make sure that they're comfortable during the process?
So if I knock on your door and ask that very question, is the answer typically yes? There are some products out there that can help.
100% yes. There's a resounding option both for cats and for dogs. So we can absolutely talk those through and see what's appropriate for your specific animal.
And some of them are maybe pharmaceuticals, but some of them are nutraceuticals. So they're not nutritional supplements. They're not pharmaceuticals. Kind of a hybrid in between all that.
Absolutely. And some of those can have really profound impact. So it's always worth trialing, whether we're using, you know, again, some of the products like Zilkeen or the alpha-casozepine-based products that are a purified milk protein, for example. Great option to trial. Works great for some cats and for dogs.
So it's like great-grandma said, in the warm cup of milk before you do something that might make you nervous?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a calming effect there in a much higher concentration than what you'd get from just that single glass of milk. So a more potent version of that relaxation.
So you're not promoting giving milk to our cats?
I am not in this moment promoting giving milk to our cats. You're correct, Steve.
Yeah, I didn't think so. So the good news is there are some tools that we have, some things we can do. What about the where we're going? So if we're going somewhere where we're going to see grandma, who happens to have six dogs, and your dog doesn't love other dogs, or those six dogs all don't love other dogs, is that a consideration as well?
I think it should be. And the way I tend to raise that with my clients and my pet parents is to ask the question, what would it look like to give your dog or your cat a home away from home? Rather than just dumping them into the living room and hoping it all goes well, think intentionally, how are we setting them up to be successful at our destination as well as during the travel itself?
We've been talking about traveling with pets. More people do that than ever before. But we also, Chris, I think Dr. Pockel, don't talk often enough about, well, we want the pets to go. Do the pets really want to go?
And some pets, I think, are very happy to go. They love being in the car, dogs and cats. Some, okay, they learn to tolerate it. We can give them products that will help them to feel a little less anxious about it. It can all work out very well. Sometimes, though, are we better off, in truth, actually, I'm talking mostly dogs here, really, boarding the dog?
I think it's a really viable option, and I say that in full disclosure as a co-owner of a boarding facility that also offers training services and board and train services. I think it's a wonderful opportunity when we consider some of the selection criteria of for who is that a good choice.
So for whom is that a good choice? And what are the things we should ask as pet parents about that facility? For example, do they have cameras? And if so, can I access that camera? Am I going to be accessing that camera every minute I'm on vacation? Probably yes. So talk about that.
Yeah, there are a couple of things there. I think asking some of the safety and security questions are really good. For example, in our facility, anywhere that we're going to work with a dog that's off leash or on a drag line, there's at least 2 fence lines or solid doors between them and freedom so that we're really mindful of safety protocols. And any facility should be able to tell you exactly what precautions they're taking to make sure that your family member is going to be in good hands while you're not there to care for them.
So 2 things. This might be an opportunity for you to say, oh my gosh, my dog can use some training or some sprucing up in that area, or forget about the vacation, just in general, to board and train is the terminology. So you board your dog, a trainer is there. And I've always been worried about it because you don't know the technique that trainer is necessarily using. And you and I have talked many times about how important it is to use positive reinforcement. How do you know that trainer is going to be doing just that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Stephen. I think if we were talking about this 5 or 6 years ago, I would have, and I did have a very different opinion. I think everything you just said, I'm still 1,000% in agreement on. And one of the things that I've been introduced to since then is the opportunity to do positive reinforcement based board and train, where we can do all the things that we would ordinarily do in coaching sessions with clients or with the dogs themselves. And the trainer, you know, who is assuming we're using appropriate methodology, and we've got some safeguards there too, they're doing a lot of the initial heavy lifting of teaching that animal the foundation skills they need to then transfer those skills back into the home environment and for the pet parent to have an easier time onboarding those skills as well, knowing that they absolutely have to be an integral part of that process as well. Otherwise, it doesn't matter what we're able to do in the facility. It's unlikely to transfer back over to the home environment.
You just answered my next question, but I have still one more. So if Dr. Pockel is a co-owner of the facility you go to, yes, positive reinforcement dog training, of course. But you don't own or co-own every facility in the United States. Not yet, anyway.
Not yet.
So how do you know that trainer is going to be using the positive reinforcement? They know what we want to hear. So they tell us that, but how do you know that's really the case?
So I love the question about methodology and how do we verify that. In some cases, we can look at some of the certifications that those trainers might hold, knowing that certain organizations really toe the line on that. I also love when the trainer is providing video of their sessions. This is what we're doing. And I also love asking the questions and having the pet parents ask those questions to say, hey, if my dog is doing, quote unquote, the right things and you're rewarding, how do you respond if they don't do the right thing?
Sometimes that's a big question.
It's a big question,
yeah,
right? And, yeah, you know, and then you can really learn a lot from those answers. You know, if you get a trainer who's saying something along the lines of, well, you know, a mild correction in that moment gets them back on track, a little bit of a red flag.
Yeah.
So I think we've got some ways to verify that information and really set the animals up for success in the process.
Well, that's what we want, Dr. Chris Pockel. We always want to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I don't mean to get personal. Who do you share your bed with? Well, if you share your bed with your dog, you are, in fact, in the majority. Most dog parents do share now not only their bedrooms, but their beds with their dogs. And there are lots of reasons. Oh, here is the most interesting data piece from slumberyard.com. 24% of the participants in their survey revealed they'd rather sleep with their dog than a human partner. 24% may not be a lot, but that's still a lot of people who say, I prefer my dog. Why? Number one reason on that list is security. Number two reason is their partner gets up in the middle of the night often and disturbs them, and their dog doesn't do that. I mean, after all, dogs don't have a beer or two before they go to bed at night. Number three is snoring. Well, actually, the truth is, lots of dogs do snore. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.